Welcome to the first in a series of conversations where we delve into some of the most pressing issues concerning AI in healthcare. Of course, there are lots of these at the moment. Great articles, great podcasts, great material, and great publications. However, what I see or observe in this conversation is they're very US, EU, and UK focused. Whilst this is great, this keeps us in a bubble. And actually, if you think about it, it's actually the rest of the world outside of this where the biggest needs are and where most of humanity lives. And so the focus of this conversation is really around LMICs and underserved populations, perhaps in the geographies we mentioned, but also who's actually doing and moving the needle on these issues, because sometimes also that's where the conversation gets stuck. Oh, we should do something about it, but who's actually doing something about it? And particularly from LMICs, what can we learn? Well, how can we learn from this? So at least as a baseline, this is a big learning for me, and I hope you as a listener will kind of come along for the ride as well. And so I guess with that, I'm very, very excited to be talking to Zhao Lu today. So welcome, Zhao. This is the first part, and we're talking today in this first part about health data poverty. Now, Zhao, you're a heavyweight in the field in general. You know, aside from your kind of early work where I got to know you leading the Consort AI and Spirit AI guidelines for reporting of clinical trials, you've also written kind of one of the seminal calls to action, or been part of the writing committee with a few other people on the call to action around health data poverty, and kind of really calling it out as we need to do something about this. So I'm really excited to talk to you about this, but maybe we can start with you telling us a little bit about yourself, and then maybe you can go into how you define health data poverty. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's really exciting to be on this podcast, and what a great topic. So my name's Zhao Lu. I'm a medical doctor by background, and I'm also nowadays a full-time academic researcher based at the University of Birmingham in the UK. I have experience working across healthcare, policy, regulation, some time in industry as well, and now in academia. And my research focuses on the evaluation and regulation of AI health technologies, focusing on safety, effectiveness, equity, and sustainability. So thanks so much for having me here.
Pleasure. So Zhao, that's so pertinent, especially the area of your focus. And I mean, there's so many rabbit holes we could go down with the areas that you've been researching and writing about. But if we focus on this area in particular, what do you define, or what has and the work that you've done define health data poverty as, and why should we in our contexts, in I guess, like, you know, if we find our context together here as the US, the EU, the UK, kind of technically the West, as it were, why should we care about this?
Yeah, maybe I can tell the story as to how we came up with the term health data poverty in the first place. So I was working on a review at the time. So I'm an ophthalmologist by background. I was interested in eye imaging data sets. And we did a mapping exercise looking at all the publicly available eye imaging data sets that we could find, and found that there was a huge disparity in terms of where the data sets were distributed around the world, and a heavy bias towards countries with higher resources, well-established health systems, well-established digital infrastructure. And there were also tons of problems with the way that those data sets were documented. So when we think about the concept of health data poverty, we wrote about this in a paper in the Lancet Digital Health, and we define it as the inability for individuals, groups, or populations to benefit from discoveries or innovations because of a lack of data that adequately represents them. So that's a bit of a mouthful, but it's really a multifaceted problem. When we talk about health data poverty, it makes us think about a lack of data, but a lack of data is only kind of the first level of the problem. So it might be that we have individuals or groups who aren't present in the data set, but then the next level down is those who are present in the data set maybe aren't accurately represented. Maybe we get more inaccuracies and errors and misrepresentations in data representing certain groups. Like, for example, if we don't capture things like ethnicity coding in a very granular level for the whole of the Asian community, which we know is a very diverse community, what does that mean for the insights that we can derive for them? And then there's almost like another level down, where our definitions around things like personality attributes, so personal attributes, aren't perfect and they aren't sufficiently granular to actually represent people. So I guess what I'm saying is that health data poverty can come from a number of different routes into affecting bias in data sets. And it can be problematic for when we do research on that data, but also when we create data-driven interventions, like, for example, AI algorithms and software.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you touched on something because, yeah, at least when, you know, when we initially think about this, at least from my perspective, we think about it, you know, think more or index more towards that first area. Mm-hmm. And I guess, at least for me, my assumption is that's linked to the concept of availability bias, and particularly with the impact you have on if that data is then used to train models, which are then going to impact care, you suddenly have this propagating problem. And I guess like the source of that, which is being propagated digitally, is just the problems that we have and inherently within A, society, and B, within mm-hmm. healthcare and how healthcare data gathering is set up, you know, a few layers down. So there's so many levels at which this plays out. And, you know, it's great that you talk about the ways that it goes, you know, further down in terms of inaccuracies within certain groups and, you know, the other things that you've mentioned. And I think what this plays out towards as well is around, we miss a trick on potentially the benefits of certain, you know, we talk about the promise of AI and we talk about the digital divide and we risk whole layers of our community or parts of our community missing out, even from being present in the data. And I think, and I guess another reflection to me is this other more ethical layer, which is, you know, people who then donate data then are the ones who don't kind of benefit from it because of the way society is set up, because the MLs are then just deployed on richer areas because that's where the money is, right? So what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I that kind of perpetuating cycle issue is definitely true. And then if you think about the fact that if you're interacting with digital tools and data generating health interventions, then in effect, that problem kind of gets worse because the data that you're generating off these existing data-driven tools are going to be, again, only targeted towards certain populations that are already accessing the data sets. I think the other issue to bring up is that sometimes the presence of the health data poverty issue within a data set isn't immediately obvious. And part of that reason is we don't currently document our data sets or label our data sets in sufficient granularity or in a sufficiently transparent way that often you can get a data set where you don't actually know what percentage represents what ethnicity because that information is just not recorded or it's, you know, poorly recorded. And so you can't actually make any, as a researcher or as an innovator, you can't make any judgments about how suitable is this. If, you know, if I want to create an algorithm that's detecting cancer or something, and let's say the whole of the UK population, but I'm not getting sufficiently granular labeling within that data set, well, I can't actually make that judgment. So, and that's maybe like a nice segue onto one of the projects that we've been working on for the last 2 years called Standing Together, which is exactly tackling this issue, trying to bring more transparency into the limitations of data sets when we think about it with an equity lens, documenting very clearly where biases may or may not be embedded in the data and what sort of attributes we should be labeling the data set with. So yeah, just a little plug there on Standing Together, which is hopefully going to be published soon. The recommendations can be found at www.datadiversity.org.
We'll try and make sure that that's some kind of in the notes that follow up on this so people can follow that. So what I'm hearing then is that we need a good way to help developers or gatherers of data create an extra layer of standardization of what is good in this type of criteria, like create it as a criteria. Because I guess what it links to me is that like diversity by design, or you're thinking about it at the beginning of the process rather than trying to catch your tail afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so defining what is good at the outset, or at least with the data set you have, you can then be able to do something about it. So making it visible, right? Making the invisible more visible in your data, I guess. That resonates a lot. And I think, so if we could just get into a bit more around, particularly around the recommendations that you had in the article. And this article was written in 2021. So maybe you could go over the recommendations, and I'd love to get your assessment, or at least from what you see and the conversations you have and what you, you know, what you read and what's out here at the moment. Where do you think we're at in terms of having moved the needle on this? What have we done well? We, the collective, we, everyone. And what do you think are the key challenges that we have still left to do?
Yeah, that's a big question. So, well, we have done some repeated investigations into mapping different data sets across other disease areas since we wrote that original article, which was really prompted by that ophthalmology use case. So we've since looked at data sets for skin cancer. We've looked at it in COVID-19. We've looked at cardiovascular data sets. And also, what was the last one? It was breast cancer. These problems with poor representation within data sets and poor labeling are really pervasive across lots of different areas. And we have to accept that ultimately it's not the data that's the problem. The data is a reflection of our society and also our health system. And so you can, to an extent, make the data as transparent as possible, but you cannot fix the data, fix the problem. Instead, the data set should be used as a tool to understand the problem. And so then the question becomes, well, how do we make sure that, what are the opportunities where, you know, a bit like a surgical sieve, those patients who are, or the communities that are within our society, where do they drop off along the health system chain all the way up to the point at which they become, you know, a sort of a data point? And that includes looking at things like accessibility to care. That includes looking at things like consent to contributing data. It includes things like participation in clinical trials, other data curation efforts. It looks at, it involves things like looking at how we code data, how we aggregate data, how we harmonize it. And there's many, many, many opportunities along that sort of almost that life cycle for health data where we can lose people. And it's a big long-term mission that we sort of need to be working on.
So that's a great call to action, and thinking about it from a whole life cycle of data lens, right? Even from before someone becomes a data point and what's their journey in there. I wanted to quickly go over the kind of also the four recommendations. So I think just if I go over them briefly, people can read them and I'll put the link here. But, you know, one was around increasing awareness within data and digital health communities. And I think that touches on, hey, we all have a responsibility across the life cycle, not just developers, but like across all of society. And like, if we think about just the clinical deployment context, you know, all the parts of that. So from a developer perspective, oh, a developer's developing an AI algorithm based on a data set. Oh, how are we proactively thinking about that? Who do we need to work with to increase that? Do we need to think about other things that we need to do to make, you talked about labeling and the attributions of it. So I like this first recommendation because it helps us think about this across. And then we're also thinking about it and like preparing for deployment and after deployment, how are we thinking about that? And what are the second and third order effects and responsibilities of the health system itself to be able to make sure that this is happening? So I like the whole life cycle approach and like pre and post deployment quality of data, right? So that's really exciting. The second is transparent communication to citizens and that bit around trust. The third is equitable digital access. So making sure that people are visible in digital format, right? In the data, because that's what we need. And couple that, which is what I liked, you coupled it with the gathering and provision. So they're both important, right? And so that, you know, the episode of care is the opportunity to gather the data in the right way and also use that to provision the right care, and they affect each other, right? And the fourth is building inclusive and representative data sets. So I think these are really nice. This is a really nice summary of recommendations. And this is great. And if I kind of come back to some of the points you made in your assessment, you talked about the whole society lens. And sometimes I think that's what makes it hard, because it's all of our responsibility. And when something becomes everyone's responsibility, it almost becomes nobody, or no one has the impetus, or like who's the driving force behind this, right? So I think that makes it hard. And you used a medical analogy, and I'll maybe use one as well. I think sometimes we talk about modifiable and non-medical modifiable risk factors, and this is a risk in society, right? I think we sometimes treat conversations like this as a non-modifiable one, like, oh, it's baked into society, this problem. So it's like, oh, we need a kind of whole society. We should really do something about it. It feels like we're treating it like a non-modified, like it's in our societal genetics. Whereas what your call to action here is, this is assailable. This is modifiable. And it comes back to digital determinants of health. They're like, these are modifiable determinants of health. And so I guess the gap for me is like, how do we flip our mindset and therefore actions that actually move the needle forward on this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, this is a big, complex problem that's entangled, and it's a, you know, kind of a ball of string, which is a collective responsibility. And I think there's an argument to be made around, you know, how, in what way can we componentize all the different aspects of it and map out where are the contributions that can be made, which stakeholders can be naturally responsible for those components. And when we actually look at it as, you know, is it a whole system-wide change that needs to be made, and or is it actually a series of small changes that brings, firstly, transparency and visibility to the issue, and then resources and a lot of will and persistence and strategic thinking to these all these different components within the ecosystem. And I think I will call out something, which is, we have to have community engagement in these kind of efforts. And that does require a substantial amount of investment, because often those who we are trying to engage on these topics are those who already start from furthest back from the starting line in the conversation. And so we as a community need to take the extra effort in kind of reaching out and bringing them into the conversation.
And can I just check who you mean by community and we, and who's who we need to reach out to?
Yeah, so in the case of underrepresented data sets, it's those who are disadvantaged, who have least access to healthcare, who are from, you know, minority ethnic groups, who have disabilities, who have other barriers that hamper their ability to access healthcare and participate in the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. And the community, us, do you mean people who are trying to implement and make the change? Being on the developer side and the clinician side myself, do you, particularly on the developer side and the innovator side for our listeners, what do you think are some of the tangible things that they can be doing in, you know, preparing for deployments, or maybe they've got algorithms that are out there in the field already? How should we or they be thinking about how to improve, you know, based on some of these recommendations? So, for example, a good one for this and part of the community is building inclusive and representative data sets, or supporting the building of that, or making sure that inclusive and representative data sets are ingested by models that are being created, or creating the attributes, as you said. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think first thing is recognizing that it's no one particular stakeholder's responsibility. And not without generalizing, my experience is that sometimes there can be a perception that this equity issue is not the issue of the people developing the technology, and it's kind of someone else's problem. But actually, it's not a problem that can be solved by just one person. This is what we're talking about in terms of a shared responsibility, right? So understanding, I think, from a developer's point of view, what your contribution to the solution or to the problem might be. And that might be because you are the one curating the data set, but it might also be because the one, maybe not curating a data set, but you're selecting a data set, or maybe you're making algorithmic choices that might bias against certain groups versus others. And there's decision-making in all of that. And being really critical around, you know, who am I trying to benefit with this innovation? What trade-offs am I making? And who within my team are making those decisions? And do we have unconscious biases that we may be unaware of? And being highly self-critical about it, but then also not being, I suppose, almost paralyzed to the point of not moving forward with that, because we still need innovation. And this is, as we've said, not a one-stop solution. But accepting that if we have to move forward with an imperfect solution that may still have a degree of bias, that may still have a degree of health data poverty, to then be really transparent about it so that then others can build off your solution and make improvements.
Good call to action there. You know, we're all part of the ecosystem. Where do we fit in that life cycle? Mm-hmm. What things do we know about that we could do? And how do we challenge ourselves on uncovering our subconscious biases and putting things into place? And I think the other thing is, like, this is also never done, really. Mm-hmm. It's always going to get there. And I guess it's always an iterative process. So also not letting perfect be the enemy of moving forward and actually taking iterative steps. So I like those, at least that's what I've taken as calls to action, particularly from the innovator side. But I think, you know, there's a lot that we can all think about. I've got a couple of other things I wanted to get into, actually. One was related to the second recommendation on transparent communications to citizens, because I think that's a really important one. You need citizens and people in general to trust the way that their data is collected and used. And part of it is that comes from them being able to benefit from that as well. You know, if we see the rhetoric and conversations in society at the moment, you know, there's a big proportion of people who would err on the side of opting out. And for me, that's also creating a big digital divide or creating a section of society that's invisible from data as well. And if the opt-outers, if we classify that, are broadly represented across all groups and covered all, across all groups, then great. But probably statistically, they might be skewed towards one area of society, which will then still exacerbate. So do you have any thoughts about that? Because for me, that's another or counterintuitive area of data invisibility, but one that's pertinent.
Yeah. And that there are risks that, I mean, there are well-founded reasons. We know that there are well-founded reasons, historical reasons as to why certain groups may choose to do that. But we also know that it may not help the situation if we are then creating innovations based off potentially biased data. And I think citizen engagement is so important, meaningful citizen engagement in understanding what is the root cause that we have certain groups that are choosing not to opt in to, you know, share data. What are their fears and concerns? Are they based off of historical reasons or are they based off of facts that are better ones to make a decision based on today? And what would help build that trust? What would help build reassurance? Do we need to do more to build trust and reassurance in certain groups? And actually, maybe that's exactly what we need to do. But then explaining the benefits of being represented in the data and going from there, I think.
Yeah, and that's at least if I was thinking about, like, in that life cycle view, who's the key contributor to that area? Feels yeah. like a governmental area of key responsibility, but then how do you get people to engage positively in that? But I think innovators or like builders also, you know, we see, you know, some of the big tech giants who people are very skeptical about, and we see that within the NHS as well, and probably plays out in other countries as well. So I think it goes back to, I think it's, you know, we all have a part to play in terms of making this come to a reality. Great thinking and go on, Joe.
Yeah, and I should say sometimes it's not, so the decision-making around contributing data isn't always like an active decision about, you know, consenting to share data. Sometimes it's an interaction like being at the front desk of a hospital to receive care and then being unwilling to tick certain boxes because you have fear of stigmatism within the health system. And then the secondary use of that data for research or innovation. And so again, back to that kind of life cycle, data life cycle map, is figuring out where the opportunities for losing people are and then recognizing that it doesn't always relate directly to this data sharing component. And so mapping out then what the concerns are at different stages.
Great. Yeah, great, really great point. And then as we kind of come to get your big, you know, big call to action to us, I think it'd be good to get your examples on maybe some good or bad examples of either. So I guess, you know, the two areas for me is like, do you have any visibility on who is currently doing some, like, move the needle on building inclusive and representative data sets? And maybe if you have any examples of like how we can make sure the ones who donate their data, particularly those who are otherwise underrepresented and feeling the biggest acute pain of the inverse care law, i.e. the people who need care most are the ones who are less likely to receive it, you know, and with digital health and AI potentially being able to exacerbate that, but could make that better if we do that right. So in that, do you have any thoughts of who needs to ensure that people who are donating their data actually receive the benefit? So sorry, that's two big questions. So firstly, who's building inclusive and representative data sets, but then a little bit about getting the benefits of the data at the end.
Yeah, so I think there's different approaches to this, and there's the kind of big efforts to collect routinely collected health data. And, you know, particularly in the UK, we have a number of health data research hubs being set up, for example, like Health Data Research UK. We have internationally a number of large scale population level sort of citizen health data collection efforts. So I'm thinking of programs like Our Future Health in the UK and the All of Us program in the US. And I think there are massive opportunities there to not rely so much on those who are accessing healthcare for specific needs and understanding more, having this kind of blanket coverage across our population. And I know within those programs, there's also specific efforts to try and reach this kind of quote, hard to reach groups, but I know there's problems with that terminology. And then I guess there are also targeted data-driven efforts which reach out to specific communities, and there are pockets of those dotted around different places. So I think in terms of your second question around, you know, how do we make sure that there's benefit back to those individuals? Well, there's generic practices in terms of making sure that those who are contributing data are getting feedback in terms of what their data is being used for, and having accountability mechanisms to mandate the showing of this is what your data is being used for, ensuring that it's responsible use in principle. There's also a different model that I've seen in the health data research data hubs, where there is a governance structure within each data hub that involves patients and the public for sort of triaging or assessing the data requests and making a judgment on whether these requests and the purpose that's described in them will bring benefit back to patients within the national health system, for example.
Interesting.
So some of these mechanisms for feedback and just involving patients and the public in the conversation, I think, are effective.
That's a good call. You know, at the end of the day, I guess like the intended benefit is going to be for patients and people and the public. And I think the key challenge is making sure that that benefit actually gets to everyone, including everyone in that piece. So that's really great. And you mentioned a few examples of organizations working on building more inclusive and representative data sets, particularly on the UK side. And I guess what we'll go into next is who might be doing that within the LMIC context as well. But that's a good connection of, like, particularly that you mentioned about routinely collected data. And so that'll be a bookmark for later on. Zhao, I guess with everything we've talked about, you know, and we're thinking about whole society view, but particularly I'm guessing that the main audience of listeners are builders interested in, or people interested in digital health, maybe clinicians, maybe people on the health system side or CCIO side, maybe investors. What's like a one wide message you'd give based on everything we've said today on this topic?
Yeah, I think I would say try and understand whichever role you're in and along this kind of, within this ecosystem, try and figure out where you can uniquely make things better or worse, and try and strive to improve that part that you can have influence over. Try and be as transparent about it as possible. Evidence your work, make it public facing, create opportunities to be accountable so that others can judge your work essentially and make sound decisions around, you know, whether they're downstream or upstream to you, how they can also respond accordingly. And try and achieve this balance of making improvements, but not being paralyzed by not being able to get it perfect, because this is a problem that is bigger than many of us, and it's entrenched, and it's at a structural and societal level, but it's all about the small changes that we individually can make.
And I think in this ecosystem, that's a really, really great call to action. You know, particularly the bit you talked about, continuous improvement, You know, that's a concept that's very familiar. You know, quality improvement. This is a part of quality. This is a part of delivering value. And if you can, if we can attach that as this is part of any efforts that we already have in place, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and create something new, bake it into how we think about quality and continuous improvement. I think that's a way to get it, I guess, operationalized much more effectively. That sounds great.
And also be very aware of what we is. We all have blind spots. We all have unconscious biases. Involve diverse voices and welcome dissent and have the conversations around that.
Great. And you talked about standing together, and you also mentioned the map, kind of a map of the data life cycle. Is there any work or output? You talked about publication coming soon. Is there any of this connected to what you've talked about that might be coming out in the work of standing together? And is like a map of this available so people can visualize this life cycle?
Yeah, well, I want to make it available now. So we have described it at various points throughout our publications. The Standing Together paper will be coming out soon, but we do have a public-facing report that can be found at datadiversity.org. And that is an international consensus-based set of recommendations around how we can be better about transparency of data sets. And then what you do with the limitations of data sets when you're thinking of, for example, developing an algorithm or doing a piece of research relating to that data. There are also a series of other papers that will be accompanying this, which are those mapping, data set mapping reviews that I mentioned in COVID, breast cancer, and heart failure. We already have the ophthalmology and the dermatology skin cancer one published, both in Lancet Digital Health. And yeah, I mean, that those are the series of upcoming papers where we try and bring some of the evidence into this conversation. And then obviously there's the health data poverty paper as well that we mentioned at the beginning.
Perfect. Thank you for sharing those resources as well. João, I think it's been great to learn from the perspective of a real expert in this field. We've managed to get a good definition. We've managed to see how far, if anything, we've come from 3 years ago when you published the initial call to action. We've got understanding of what the recommendations are and how they might fit together in an overall kind of landscape of people who are, you know, going from creating data sets to, like, at the end, impacting people all the way through, and who the people are in there and how we also all need to work together. So there's some great calls to action there. And I'll try to summarize them as well. But I just wanted to say thank you so much for taking the plunge and being the first person that agrees to speak to me on this, about this very, very important topic. And I think this is a really, really nice segue onto the part two of this, where we'll be speaking to a professor in Brazil who has actually tried to do something about the fourth recommendation, which is building inclusive and representative data sets. So, João, with that, I just want to say thank you so much for a great conversation. And I think, you know, I'm certainly galvanized to go back to my organization and say, hey, how can we do some of these things better? And I hope the listeners have too.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks, Al.